And the Jews in Majorca find out. So they write to the community and they say to him, to the Kehillah, either send him back to us or excommunicate him. So the Kehillah in France says, why should we excommunicate him? You're the ones who are imposing the ban. It's an insult to the person you expel, like Bar Kamtza, which caused the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. Interestingly, this same level of hesitation is found in one of the greatest respondents of the 19th century, the Chassam Sofer in Pressburg. He had refused to allow any of his writings to be published. A further Pesach-related question was asked in 1708 regarding a document which was due for payment on Chol HaMoed Pesach, but the document had a tear in it and it had been repaired with glue, but the glue was made out of chometz.
Welcome to History for the Curious. I'm Menno Reisner, and I host the internationally renowned lecturer, dynamic historian, and tour guide, Rabbi Aubrey Hirsch. Experience our history, confront dilemmas, and reveal the untold stories of 3,000 years of Jewish heritage, from Paris to Cairo, from the Russian Tsar to Maimonides, and from the Sinai Revelation to the French Revolution. Join the fastest-growing Jewish history podcast in the world by subscribing to this channel and discovering the events that have shaped us into who we are today. Rabbi Hirsch, welcome back. It's been some time since we recorded. You had a last-minute trip to Abu Dhabi, of all places.
It's true, yes.
Business trip and also some stuff for the podcast, which yes. I think we'll find out soon. So welcome back to the final part of this series on Responsa, on Shinus and Chuvus, which will also have some Pesach-related material, seeing that it's Erev Pesach now. I'm not sure when we're releasing this, but probably Chol HaMoed, we'll see. And I just want to thank both Diane Posen and Diane Hull for taking their time to come out. We've had great feedback, and thank you again, Rabbi Hirsch.
So, to return to last week's topic about shuls, which seems to have generated much discussion, we dealt with congregants, the individual mispalel, and people who wanted to be able to come to shul, but they needed a seat. Sometimes the situation is almost the opposite, that the last place they want to be is in shul. What then? In fact, we'll see how excommunication features in regards to shuls with perhaps a greater frequency than we would have expected. Now, listeners may remember when we did a series on the Maram of Rottenburg that we asked the question. There was a village with 10 Jews, 10 men, and one wanted to leave, and the rest of them said, you can't, because then we won't have a minyan. And the Maram said, yes, the tzibur, the community, has precedence over the individual, and he can't leave town until he finds a replacement, basically. So here's a sort of different theme on the above. The Knesset Yecheskel was asked that there was an old custom of Jews living in a number of small villages to assemble for prayer on Yom Kippur and Purim in a particular village where there is a Sefer Torah. And one year on Purim, one man decided to stay at home, and he read the Megillah on his own and refused to join. As a result, obviously, there wasn't a minyan, and the others were unable to fulfill the idea of reading the Megillah with a minyan. And the question was, should this person be fined? To which he answers, well, everyone actually fulfilled the main mitzvah, which is reading the Megillah. The only thing that didn't happen is Pirsumei Nisa, the publicizing of the miracle by being in a minyan. So he can't be banned, but he can receive lashes.
Lashes?
Yes, as in Malchus.
Yeah.
However, he adds, we know that the Meirotenberg and the Marshal and the Ramar all say that these Malchus can be redeemed with money. So he has to pay a fine to be assessed by the leaders of the minyan. And then he writes, when determining the fine, they should be guided by piety and rid themselves of any feelings of revenge. And he, on the other hand, should promise never to act like this again. If he does, he and all his possessions should be placed in cherem.
Not to go too off the point, but is this something that we see generally, that you can be fined for doing a public sort of disservice and have malchus and be replaced by money?
So, firstly, in the olden days, the areas of control that Bezdin or that the Rav had was far greater, and he was often the go-between between secular authorities and the Kehilla. And the idea that you can redeem things, we find that, for instance, with regards to certain reasons why the community would have a fast, would undertake a voluntary fast. And it says that a teacher, Talmud Chacham, and others should redeem it with money because they can't afford to be weakened by it, because then the public loses out. So, yeah, it's not unheard of. Now, the Lechem Mishnah was asked, and this is in the 1600s, there was a town in Italy that declared that no one is allowed to daven in any other shul for more than 3 days in a row, once again under threat of excommunication. And the agreement was signed by most of the community. One particular scholar, Talmud Chacham, left the shul to pray in a yeshiva where he's been hired as a teacher. And he says it's a mitzvah to daven where he teaches, and that mitzvah overrides the community's agreement. He also says that in the yeshiva they daven faster, which is an unusual one, and that the classes begin immediately after tefillah. So if he prayed in the synagogue, he'd be late. And the yeshiva would object to this and cut his salary. And anyway, he said, I didn't sign the agreement in the first place. The answer? If the majority of the members signed the agreement, then the scholar may not leave the shul to daven, and his arguments that he's doing it for a mitzvah of whichever kind do not hold water. And as for the fact that he didn't sign the agreement, so the Lechem Mishnah says about himself that my rabbi and teacher, the Marash Dam, said that in matters of communal enactments, we follow the majority. And as long as it was approved by the rabbis and lay leaders of the community, it stands. And then a century later, the Chacham Tzvi was asked a related question, which once again comes with quite some historical narrative or even historical baggage, somewhere between 1705 and 1712. The author of the question lived in a city where there was a congregation of Spanish and Portuguese Jews. The consensus of assumption, I would say, is that this is a reference to London, because it was a community that was rapidly growing after the resettlement of the Jews in England about 50 years earlier. And the members of this Spanish and Portuguese synagogue were bound by a vow of excommunication not to pray at any other minyan within 5 mil, which is about 10 miles or so, of their shul. Anywhere, any other shul within that radius. But the community hadn't really objected to the building of an Ashkenazi shul, and from time to time, individual members of the Sephardi synagogue would pray in the Ashkenazi one. And the questioner complains that in the Spanish and Portuguese synagogue, they were very sort of weak in their religious observance, and yet they led the service and they read the Torah, and so that's why he wants to leave. Is it permitted? To which the Chacham Tzvi gives a very sharp response, which appears in his Truvas, and he says that, well, allowing non-observant people to lead services at the Sephardi synagogue is a chilul Hashem, and therefore the letter writer and his group should leave the shul and ignore the vow of excommunication. And finally, on shuls, something far more prevalent in the olden days, and that was the private shul. In the early 1500s, the town of Reggio in Italy had a minyan in a private home. Now, the minyan was open to the public, but the owner of the home got into an argument with one of the people praying there, and he told him to leave and don't come back. But the guy did come back, and he said that Rabbeinu Gershom, in the 10th century, made a series of bans. One of them was the prohibition against the sort of the host of a minyan stopping anyone davening in his house. He either has to allow everyone to daven there or expel everyone. That was Rabbeinu Gershom's cherem. So what does the homeowner do? He says, fine, okay, no problem. He closes the minyan down and opens a new one. And in order to get into this new minyan, you had to sign a contract giving the homeowner the right to expel anyone he wanted. And he then asked the Maram Padua if he's allowed to do this, and the Maram Padua says yes. But the guy who'd been kicked out, he wasn't very happy, so he brought in other rabbis. And in fact, eventually the homeowner died and the son continues the shul under the same conditions. So this question reaches Krakow, where the Ramah was the chief rabbi. The Ramah, by the way, being the second cousin of the Maram Padua. The Ramah gets his brother-in-law, who is a dayan there, of Yosef Katz. If you've ever been to the Beis HaKvaros at the back of the Ramah synagogue, so Yosef Katz is buried just outside of that sort of railing enclosure where the Ramah is, just to the right if you're facing the Kvarim. So he got Rabbi Yosef Katz to send a response saying that the minyan has to remain open to everyone. And in fact, the Sheiris Yosef of Katz uses the Talmudic ruling that it's prohibited to remove public access from a path that the masses have already established once it is there, even on private property. And the same is true with a minyan that was open to the public.
So you're saying that once a person opens a private minyan in his home, he can't even shut it down? Even if he wants it to end?
So I don't know whether nowadays a private minyan in a shul, which gathers not as a shul, but on a Friday night, they have a minyan. I don't know, but I would doubt that we would extend it to there, because this is not sort of almost communally available. Once a week, you know, 10 people gather around his dining room. I don't think that is the same. I don't.
Might have been relevant to the gardens during COVID.
Quite possibly, yes. Although, once again, this was not created as a place. It was clearly time-sensitive and, you know, temporary. So the Ramah himself quotes his cousin, the Maram Padua's answer, but he says that's okay, somebody who opens a shul on condition. And that condition does work if that's how you open the shul in the first place. The Mishnah Brura follows the view, therefore, that it is prohibited, but he comes up with an additional reason. It's an insult to the person you expel, like Bar Kamtza, which caused the destruction of the Beis HaMikdash. And therefore you may not expel him, even if he does have access to another shul, and even if yours is a private shul. However, the 19th century Italian Pesek, the Zera Emes, adds that you are allowed to expel somebody from this shul for being quarrelsome. In other words, if there's a personal grudge between two people, then, you know, you resolve it. But somebody who causes machlekas with a number of different people, the disruption justifies expulsion. And finally on this matter, the Piskei Truvas writes that this idea of being quarrelsome and being able to be expelled also applies to somebody who talks during davening and Kriyas HaTorah. Of course, you should try first speaking to them privately and asking them to stop. However, as a last resort, expulsion is allowed because he is disrupting the shul.
Interesting.
So, yes, that should be part of the calculation if people are thinking of doing the one or the other. But let's now deal with the most important person in shul, not the rabbi, the chazan, and various situations. So the Run in 14th century Spain was asked the following question. There was an individual who lived in Perpignan in France with his wife and children. He goes to Mallorca to try, not for holiday, but to try and make a living. And while he is there, the shul hires him as the chazan for 3 years. And after a while, he says, listen, my family is located in France. I'm here in Mallorca. I want to bring them over. So the community are scared that he'll do a runner. So they tell him the following. You can go as far as Barcelona, which is the mainland, because Mallorca is an island. And from there, send a message to your family, tell them to come and join you in Barcelona, and then you can come back. But if you go back to Perpignan, we will excommunicate you. Okay. So what happens?
Quite hard to prove these things those days.
Well, you'll see how it is found and becomes public knowledge. So this guy just carries on travelling and ends up in Perpignan. And the Jews in Mallorca find out. So they write to the community and they say to him, to the Kehillah, either send him back to us or excommunicate him. So the Kehilla in France says, why should we excommunicate him? You're the ones who are imposing the ban. You excommunicate him. If you don't want to talk to him again, that's fine. But what's it got to do with us? So the Mallorca writes to the Run and says, well, what are we supposed to do? And the Run says, you can't impose a full cherem on the individual, but he can be excommunicated by the community in France for 30 days. And that means no one can approach him, as we mentioned earlier, he can't be part of a minion, but the community is not required to do more than that.
Was his crime the fact that he didn't keep to his contract?
Yes, and that was the condition.
Oh.
So,
maybe we could do a series for another time, generally on the shul. Like you started off by saying that the most important person in the shul is the chazan. I'm assuming some of it was said in jest, but
yes.
I think the chazan did play a more pivotal role in history than probably nowadays. Didn't it?
A more pivotal role, I don't know, but definitely a role beyond the one that a chazan would play today, especially in the more religious, the more Haredi communities, where even if they have a chazan, that's just almost a job that they do in the evening, and that's not their full-time occupation.
Right.
So, yeah, in that regard, it is different. Now, the Mari Brunner was asked, at what point does a chazan's voice become unacceptable?
I think many people would have very strong opinions on that, surely.
They would, not necessarily halachic ones, though.
No.
And he answers that the voices of the Levim who sang in the Beis HaMikdash had to be pleasing, and he proves that from a posuk, which Rashi explains that the music and the sound had to be harmonious, and when the voice of a Levi was no longer resonant, he is disqualified as a person able to sing in the Beis HaMikdash. And since our tefillahs have replaced the service in the Beis HaMikdash, and song is an integral part of tefillah, as long as the chazan's voice sounds smooth, he's acceptable. But if it sounds shaky or broken, he should not continue to officiate.
I have heard of a certain shul that the chazan's been davening there for decades, and he definitely doesn't sound like he used to in his youth. And I was told there that one can't halachically ask him to step down. Is there a basis for that? It seems what you just said would seem to contradict that.
In the way that you mentioned earlier, we need to do a series on the chazanim, perhaps also on other positions in the shul and in schools, firing a teacher. Moshe Feinstein has a number of tshuvas on this where he shows it's very difficult to do unless they're given a very fixed contract, which the Mari Brunner refers to and was more the case in the olden days because they kept on changing.
So a controversial series coming up.
Well, I don't know, but an interesting series. And also on the Rov, for instance, giving over the position to their son when they pass on or when they retire, how simple is that and how straightforward? Also, point of contention. For some other time now. Last question on chazanim. Can Yaakov Francis serve as a chazan? Once again, it's the Lechem Mishnah. And he is told as follows. 15 years ago, Yaakov Francis suddenly renounced his Judaism and converted to Christianity. Right, not the type of day-to-day question you get nowadays. He immediately regretted what he did and did tshuva. In fact, he does so in an unbelievable way. And the question is, he's kept his face covered for the last 15 years as a sign of remorse and has been steadfast in his repentance. Is he qualified to be appointed as chazan and shechet? To which the answer is that the Rambam writes in Hilchos Tefillah, talking about a Kohen who served idols of Avodah Zarah, that no matter whether he was forced to do so or he did so unintentionally, a Kohen can never give Birkas Kohanim again. Or, for instance, a Kohen who became an apostate. Even if he did Tshuva, he can no longer carry out Birkas Kohanim. However, a Chazan is, according to the Maharal Rothenberg, less rigorously treated than a Kohen, and therefore he writes about himself, the Lechem Mishnah, even though compared with the great rabbis, I am no more than the hem of their garment. It is my opinion that Yaakov Francis is qualified to serve as chazan and shechet.
Very interesting. Do we know why a Kohen is held to a higher standard?
Well, it's a Doraisa. It's a biblical mitzvah. It's right. Very different in that respect. And since, as you mentioned, I'm just back from Abu Dhabi this week, I will quote a Rosh in the 14th century who never lived there, but he was asked about Muslim customs. Someone wanted to donate a rug decorated with black designs to hang the two rugs on either side of the Oren Kodesh for ornamental purposes. And the Rosh starts by answering, I researched this matter, and I found out that here in Toledo, it has been the custom to forbid sitting on such rugs in shul, and certainly to prevent them being displayed alongside the Oren Kodesh. Now, when he says he researched the matter, it's because he was originally from Germany and he fled to Spain. And he becomes Rav of a Sephardi town, even though he was Ashkenazi. So in some matters, he simply needed to know more about the facts before he could decide, because there was no Muslim that lived anywhere in Ashkenaz, right, in Germany or Austria. And then he says that people say that the black design on the rugs represent the place in Mecca where Muslims worship. And I can attest to this because there is actually a permanent TV station in Abu Dhabi. And all it shows is this mosque in Mecca, which has the black Kaaba stone, day and night, people circling round and round the stone. So it is black. It's just a black square, so to speak. And then the Rosh adds, some say it represents Mercury and that they are now bowing down to Avodah Zarah. And they explained to me that in Arabic it is called Sagada, which relates to the Aramaic word to bow down, because they use the rug to bow down on, and therefore it's forbidden to use this in the shul.
So that would make sense, because if it was purely decorative, I mean, we've already mentioned in this series before that we see in history that we have adopted certain customs, whether it's removing the shoes to pray, that as long as something isn't literally contradicting, you know, prayers themselves, it would be allowed. I mean, I think even the windows in certain older shuls, stained glass, that's taken from the church, isn't it?
Well, it was a method of beautifying the church, but you find it in palaces, you find it in various other places. It wasn't specifically religious. What you do find is the Bach is asked about using religious Christian melodies in shul, you know, to what extent.
But that, again, would be like part of the prayer itself.
Yeah. Okay, and we will conclude with three Pesach-related tshuvas. The first two are from Reb David Oppenheim, who was the Rav in Nicholsburg originally, and then of Prague, and in fact all of Bohemia, and he was there from 1702 till 1736, where he died. And the first question is about Chol HaMoed, where we know that four people are called up to the Torah instead of the usual three. And the question being, which aliyah do you give to the Rav, the third one or the fourth one, the extra one? And he says, in Frankfurt and many parts of Germany, the custom is to give Shlishi, the third one, whereas in Prague and Moravia, it is Ravi, the fourth one. And he explains both positions, the first being that the third aliyah follows the order of importance. Kohen first, Levi second, and therefore Shlishi goes to the most important Yisrael, which also explains why, on the average Shabbos, the aliyah is reserved for the rabbi in many Ashkenaz communities. Whereas the other opinion says, no, the extra aliyah is in honor of Yontov, and therefore it's the most important. And Rottenheim adds, if you live in a town with no fixed minhag, it would be appropriate to call the more senior person for Shlishi. So all Pesach programs should be calling up the more senior person for Shlishi.
I hope Mr. Wagner's listening.
I'm sure he is. He's a big fan. A further Pesach-related question was asked in 1708 regarding a document which was due for payment on Chol HaMoed Pesach. But the document had a tear in it, and it had been repaired with glue. But the glue was made out of chometz. And the ownership of the document during Pesach would constitute ownership of chometz. So what do you do now? So Rav Oppenheim answers, using a Mishnah in the third Perek of Psachim, which says that chometz being used to plug a hole in a trough and which therefore won't be removed during Yontov, because you would destroy the vessel, is permissible, especially if it's less than the size of a kzayis, which would allow this document to be handled. The only remaining worry is that scraps of it might fall into food, for which he advises, therefore, either that the Beis Din should make a copy and they should burn the original, or they should give the document to a non-Jew to collect from the other party. And finally, of all the responsa that we have covered, I think this one will give the greatest sense of attachment to both Torah and Mesiras Nefesh. It's dated 1941, Forest 45 in Sverdlovsk, which was deep in Siberia. It was sent to the Chabina Rov, who'd been exiled there from Lvov, from Lemberg, by the Russians at the beginning of the Second World War. And despite being in Siberia in World War II, he carried on not only learning Torah, but writing Torah, often on the paper which had covered cement bags. And some of them were eventually smuggled out and printed in his responsa, Doviv Mishorim. But what's equally outstanding is that the person asking, which we see from the reply, is presumably quite young because he's referred to as Habocha Hamafur Moshala. But he asks this question nonetheless, and the question is, Ein lehem rak kzayis echod shel matzah. They've only got one kzayis of matzah. What should they do? Im yechalku ha-kzayis, should they split it into two, and each of the two people should have a half a kzayis, or should one person eat the whole kzayis? Question which was unfortunately relevant at the time, and he paskens that one person should eat the kzayis.
It's like we've said many times, what's fascinating about the tshuvas and the responsa that we have collated from history is an in-depth view into people's struggles, into Jewish struggles that are so uniquely of their time. Rabbi Hirsch, I wanted to ask you, just in terms of halachic tshuvas in general, nowadays we have access to pretty much all the sforim one can possibly wish for, but back in the day when a average Jewish household might have just had, if anything, a Shulchan Aruch or similar sforim, and a responsa came through which seemed to, let's say, contradict or have a different opinion, are responsa more authoritative than the sforim that we have on our shelves, the Shulchan Aruch, the Rambam?
Okay, so the Maril is famous both for his Sforim on Minhagim and Halacha and his responsa. And he writes that somebody had asked him and said he felt that they should not rely on Tshuvas. The Maril says, on the contrary, they are practical Halacha, and we should rely on them more than the sort of the codifiers, because the codifiers are not present at the time when a decision is being made. So that these Svarim, like the Shulchan Aruch, are summarizing decisions in the Gemara, in the Rishonim, etc., whereas a Tshuva comes from an actual case, and it should be more of a prime source of authority.
And would you say that all tshuvas are seen that way, depending on time and who wrote it?
I mean, that's a very broad question. It depends on circumstances. But, I mean, perhaps to give two different types of examples, and that will illustrate somewhat of the answer. There is a famous sefer of responsa called the Trumas HaDeshen, which was written by Rabbi Yisrael Isselin in Austria in the 15th century. It has 354 questions and answers, because that's the gematria of the Hebrew word deshen. And throughout the centuries, the halachic authorities viewed the Trumas HaDeshen as a sefer which was actually written by the author, meaning he invented the questions for the responsa. So, for instance, the Chidah says that Trumas HaDeshen is not a regular Tshuva Sefer, because the rabbi himself raised the question and gave the answer. You might now think, well, this is, you know, almost cheating. They weren't real questions. In fact, the opposite is true. They are very authoritative. The Shach and Taz both state clearly that since the questions in the Trumas HaDeshen were authored by a Talmud Chacham, we have to view even the question itself very carefully to see what it does and does not ask, because the question is deliberately worded. And his psak is very important to Ashkenazim. The Rama quotes almost all of his decisions in Shulchan Aruch. And in fact, Bomberg in Venice already printed his Truvas in 1519, which gives you an idea of how important they were and, so to speak, how likely they were to sell. And it was reprinted in 1546.
I mean, I'm assuming that the answers given were broadly based on the questions he was being presented with. I'm sure that
sometimes, and that seems to be more indicated by recent research, but many of them seem to be very much written, both question and answer, by the Truma Sadeshin. So, you know, from that, Truva seemed to be the deciding factor. Yet, we know that the Rosh, who we mentioned earlier, wrote three sets of Svarim, Tosfos HaRosh, Piskei HaRosh, and Responsa. And when there are differences between the three, we follow the Talmudic commentary, not the Responsa. So did the Rosh have a different view? The Netziv discusses this and says, no, it's very simple. The reason we follow the Piskei HaRosh is no reflection on the authority of Responsa. It's simply that the Rosh's son knew that the Talmudic commentary was written later than the Responsa. And if they differ, it's because the Rosh changed his mind. And the Netziv adds, but in general, Responsa are of greater importance because they are practical and because you get a siyata d'shmaya. God helps the person writing. He writes, Torah ha-yotze b'shas ha-teshuva. While you're writing Responsa, Odif is better. And in fact, this idea is echoed by the Chazon Ish later, when he was approached to answer a particular question, to which he asked, is this lemaisa? Is what you're asking me real and practical? Because there's a certain siyata d'shmaya given to Chachamim when they are required to answer a concrete question. And now the Netziv adds something very interesting, which perhaps answers a question that we asked 3 weeks ago. Why did some Gedolim not print Responsa? So the Netziv says, many scholars didn't publish because Responsa are more authoritative and they didn't want people to rely on their opinion. Now, I don't know if he's saying that that's the only reason. He doesn't go into more detail there, but he states this as an absolute fact. And the context that the Netziv is talking about is also interesting. Rav Bamberger, the famous 19th century Würzburger Rav, asked his sons not to print his Responsa after he died. But Rav Zechel Bamberger, the rabbi of Kissingen in Germany, wrote to two great rabbinic authorities, the Netziv and Rabbi Yitzchak Elchanan Spekter in Kovna, to ask, does he have to follow his father's wishes on this? And the Netziv says, no. Once the Torah was written by your father as halacha, it cannot be destroyed, it should not be destroyed, it may be printed, despite the author expressing reluctance, because it is Torah.
I find that to be a fascinating psak, because surely he was wary about the wording, that it might not be relevant to the masses.
But remember, he has used it as a responsa to somebody asking. And the Netziv says, at that point, with the siyata d'shmaya you get when writing it, it is Torah.
Wow.
And in the end, the collection of Rabamberger's Truvas were published by his grandson in Frankfurt in 1925, and he refers to the permission given by the Netziv and adds the letter that they got from Yitzchak Elchanan, who also said that they should be printed, but that his grandfather's hesitation should be honored by adding the initial reluctance at the Hakdama as the introduction. And interestingly, this same level of hesitation is found in one of the greatest respondents of the 19th century, the Chasam Sofer in Pressburg. He had refused to allow any of his writings to be published, but his son writes that before the Chasam Sofer died, he and some of his father's Talmidim pleaded with the Chasam Sofer and overcame his objections and finally got permission to go to print. And it's interesting because the Chasam Sofer might not have wanted his Truvas printed, but he did collect them. He did collate them, which is why they had them. Although there were other Talmidei Chachamim who didn't even want to go that far. They didn't even collect or preserve their Responsa.
Wow. I think a practical takeaway could be seeing even the level of reluctance for them to be published. How important it is when one does ask a shaila to a Rav nowadays. We have the ability to do a phone call, to do an email possibly, to show the level of detail needed for the individual circumstances, because how much of Pesach is dependent on it.
Yep.
And back in the day, they didn't have that luxury. Rabbi Hirsch, thank you. I think that was almost a Shabbos Hagodol style history series with a lot of Torah in, more than usual,
yes,
but still a very strong historical factor throughout. So thank you very much. And I hope you and all the listeners have a wonderful Yom Tov, and no doubt we'll see you after for a brand new series.
It's a shame.